Ich möchte Ursula Biemann aus Zürich begrüßen und ein paar einleitende Worte zu Ihren Arbeiten sagen, während Sie noch ein bisschen die Technik probiert. Ursula Biemann ist Künstlerin, Kuratorin und Wissenschaftlerin mit Wohnort in Zürich, wo sie am Institut für Theorie der Hochschule der Künste forscht. Ihre künstlerischen und kuratorischen Projekte realisiert sie dennoch weltweit. Sie hat in New York studiert, erst an der School of Visual Arts und dann später am Whitney Independent Study Program. Und seit dieser Zeit hat sie zahlreiche künstlerische Forschungsprojekte zu Grenzen, Migration und Geografie, Mobilität, Technologie und Gender realisiert und mit ihren Video-Essays eine eigene ästhetische Sprache entwickelt, in der sich geografische und videografische Räume überlagern. Ursula Biemann hat komplexe Formen der Zusammenarbeit initiiert, ausgehend von ihren künstlerischen Objekten kuratorisch gearbeitet, in Projekten wie Geografie und die Politik der Mobilität oder B-Zone Becoming Europe and Beyond sowie Maghreb Connection Kairo. Auf einen Aspekt dieser Arbeit wird sie heute auch nochmal eingehen. Letzteres wurde auch in einer Buchpublikation dokumentiert, 2003 erschienen zusätzlich noch Stuff It, The Visual Essay in the Digital Age und 2008 die Monographie Mission Reports, Artistic Practice in the Field. Ihre Arbeiten, zum Beispiel Black Sea Files und Sahara Chronicle, von der wir heute auch etwas sehen werden, zum nordafrikanischen Migrationssystem, werden in internationalen Ausstellungen und Festivals gezeigt. Sie haben viele Einladungen international durch Vorträge, Workshops und so weiter, Retrospektiven erfahren, auch einen Ehrendoktortitel in Umeå und Schweden bekommen. Und jetzt sind wir gespannt, was Sie uns erzählen zu Ihrer investigativen Videopraxis, und die Sie uns anhand der Video-Essays Sahara Chronicle, das ich schon genannt hatte, und Contained Mobility zur Diskussion stellen wollen. Ich danke Ihnen.
Thank you very much. I'm going to switch to English, so that we address our guests as well. And because my work really is mainly done in English, and so it just seems a lot more natural for me to do it that way. Knowing that I have only 30 minutes, I reduced it to just speak about Sahara Chronicle and drop contained mobility, which we looked at briefly yesterday in the workshop. So I'm using investigative video and field research as a form of artistic practice to speak about globalization processes and migration and transnational spaces mainly. And this has brought me into lots of different geographies, researching on the ground in extraterritorial spaces such as refugee camps, border zones, tourist resorts, all forms of camps and so on, to kind of document what people do on the ground and connect it to a macro level of theoretical reflection and of connecting it to a larger systemic approach, actually. So this project here has brought me to research in the Sahara for about 3 years almost. And it has been developed in the context of a research project and curatorial project which I had initiated called the Maghreb Connection, because this here is about a migration network that crosses all of Sahara, and I thought it was most interesting or more significant to develop it in the context of a network, also a research network. So I create contexts within which I can operate better and which makes more sense in terms of the topic that I research. The Maghreb countries, and I don't mean only Morocco, Algeria and Tunisia, but also Libya and Mauritania, so all of the Arab North, they have a very long migration history to Europe as labor migration. But recently, or more recently, it has also there has been some major transformation in the sense that more and more West African migrants have started to cross the Maghreb in order to come to the Mediterranean and Europe, and have transformed the Maghreb into a transit zone, which it hadn't been before in that sense. And so the Sahara Chronicle is basically a documentation of this moment of transformation, of major reconfiguration of the space through mobility and through this performative moment of migration. Until recently, Africans could actually move to any other African country, settle down and find work. North Africa particularly was really a free zone of mobility, more or less, and with the consolidation of Europe and the establishment of Schengen space, control of the southern European border has been kind of delegated to North African countries, trying to put them under contract to help stem the migration flows coming from the south, meaning from West African countries. So that that free mobility within Europe, which is the symbol for Schengen space, had actually been established at the price of free mobility in Africa, because now they had to obtain a visa in order to even move into other African countries. So this has created a lot of disenchantment among travelers in that region, because suddenly they couldn't move into that space that they felt was their legitimate space of mobility. So this is actually the subject matter, or the background to this story that I'm going to map out here. It's Sahara Chronicle is something that has taken me 3 years to develop, and in that time I have I have gone to all these different pivotal sites of migration that are relevant to the cross-border migration. Some of them are in the center of countries that are major hubs of migration for people crossing through. Others are border passages or ports on the Atlantic front, and all kinds of deportation camps and other means of moving around. And the first thing, of course, when I start a research project is always looking at the whole landscape of media representation that already cover this kind of topic. And in the case of transit migration, media have a very particular way to look at this. It always directs the spotlight onto the failure of the stranded migrant, celebrating the police effort of, you know, all the victorious passages go undocumented. So it condenses this whole symbol of clandestine migration into this moment of refugees in a boat that are intercepted by the police, and always locking them into this one kind of freeze frame of the raft of the Medusa that's always drifting off the shores of Senegal. It's kind of this endlessly never reaching a destination type of image. But it celebrates, of course, at the same time, police efforts, and seems to say that there is this possibility of aborting resistance practices. And this form of migration is what I see as a form of resistance, of course, to all these new kind of reinforced border controls. I have noticed that many artists have also shown some fascination with border regimes, border technologies, and all these new measures that have been set in place to control the free mobility. And I've always been somewhat suspicious of this strategy to focus so much on the border as it is. Even if you have a critical reading of it, you cannot help reproducing it and giving it importance and giving it more space. So I have decided to look more the other way and look at all these resistance practices as these underground and subversive movements that take place, or sometimes also at police efforts that don't seem to work very well, that kind of go lose themselves in the sand, or the kind of action that lead to nothing. And so one of the first sites I went to see is Agadez. It's a town in the heart of Niger. Niger is a country that's immediately south of Algeria and Libya. So it's the major migration route that goes through it. Agadez is the southern gate to the Sahara. So after Agadez, no one goes alone. That's the kind of the last stop before the big passage. You have to stay, organize yourself, get information, buy provisions for the route and so on. So I thought that this could be potentially an interesting place to go and document. Also, I wanted to go to a place where it's not the end of a journey, but it's the beginning, where everything is potentially still possible, so that we get to see and hear also from people what this all means to them. So I'd like to show you a first part of this clip that is shot in this desert truck terminal. So we have sound. Is this coming through here?
Oui, c'est un coxeur. Un coxeur, c'est lui qui fait... Oui, celui qui fait voyage aux frères nigériens pour aller en Libye ou bien en Algérie. Il nous enlève notre commission. Tu vois, je suis un agent. On a une agence. Tu vois.
لوكتي ننتي مش ذلك سنه انا شكن سانديكا منا شغا تركين لينكين هكا هاري يزو غيرين لينكين هكا سي ان دوكان هكا اما يزو ديك تون كاتا تون 2004 نا فيتا سانديكاني هكا انا دا ادريس بسموتوتي انا دا ادريس نن شكن غراج غشيتان ن اس تي تي ترانسبور سهريا وند دوك يا تي شكن موتوتيني هاري صعبه دسو كو نيجيريا كو غانا كو ني غريني sai ya zo nan ne haka ya zo nan ne direct gare mu haka sai ya shigo motoci kuma suna a regir ne kuma da takardu ne da telefon da komi da komi ne to jura kwanta ce mashi duk mota wanda za ta tafiya ne tana da guda mu kuma muna da guda nan gare mu haka sai ya shigo motoci sécurité ne muna da abun nan ne haka kaman wanda za su kawo rufile da kaya sai mu yi changement su ba mu karbira mu doka masa kam difi ne haka tono goma shine za mu amsa gare su ne wanda za su kai mu nan
ne Les Ghanéens qu'on a eu une vingtaine, qui les cassent ça, Moutani? Ngouta? Kinkar? Ghanéouta? Lui, son rôle, c'est quoi? C'est lui qui reçoit les étrangers. Il a des contacts en Côte d'Ivoire, au Cameroun, au Togo, Bénin, Ghana. Donc, quand il reçoit les passagers, il amène à la société. Donc, il a son intérêt sur chaque passager qu'il gagne en traversant d'ici pour aller à Durko. Donc, s'il vient, il vient avec son adresse, comme il a un bureau. Donc, c'est lui qui le coupe les billets d'ici à aller à Durko. Pour aller à Durko. Tu vois, donc il est irresponsable. C'est lui qui reçoit les gens. Voilà, c'est lui qu'on connaît. C'est lui le responsable. C'est lui qui a coupé les billets d'ici à aller du coup.
So we see them buying tickets. I try to bring some calm into the whole illegal business by showing the commercial side of it, by reversing somewhat the media imagery, which always captures this, takes a great spectacle out of this illegal migration, and suggesting these images usually suggesting an urgency and emergency, and kind of suggest the necessity of political intervention. Whereas I try here to propose a very unexcited form of representation, show it as a daily life, migration as a social practice. Integrated in the business of the countries that they cross through, bringing also a lot of business in these new border cities. I couldn't reduce it to a media critique of the image, but I think because that media imagery is so extremely narrow, it leaves a lot of space to really fill in a lot of new information, a lot of new different kind of files, so that we get a much larger and better understanding of what the system is like. And maybe that's a bit different to other ways of dealing with migration in the arts, which has focused for many years on issues around identity and biography and migration stories, addressing the migrant on an experiential level, whereas I try to show the systemic side of migration, and to simply understand this community also as people who have developed a kind of a system of logistics and social organization and topographic knowledge that is very proper to this tribe, because of course who is running this business are the Tuareg nomadic community in the desert, which have always secured this kind of north-south connection. Now what he's saying here is actually rather interesting, that that the boss, as I present all these different figures that play a role, from the water bearer to the top coaxer who is running kind of all these connections, the boss who has these trucks and sells tickets is someone who brings these migrants to the border and just drops them there, and when they get intercepted by the Libyan police, they get sent back on his same truck, and he gets money for that. So that the migrant has actually
really become a kind of the subject of negotiation from very high levels of international diplomatic dealings to down to the ground, this everyday kind of business. And doing my research, I also found out that Germany has donated to Libya these airplanes, these drones, unmanned airplanes, that for the surveillance of the southern part of their desert. In getting a better control and also stemming migration flows coming through Libya from the south. And so I was interested in finding out more about these images that are produced by drones, because I always feel that migration no longer takes place only in a physical space. You also have to start entering these electronic and virtual spaces because migration also takes place in these areas. And that if we only document things on the ground, we don't do the full scope of things. We don't do our full job. So file number two, if you can get back, this is always very tricky here. How do we get back to the menu? We don't. Well, then I just move on to the next chapter. How did we do that? I wonder. Well, it would just go, yeah, this is desert drone, this is the second file. So it's a collection of 12 video documents, which I usually show in forms of installations, projected and on monitors, all together in one space. It's never meant to be seen as a cinematic viewing in that kind of sense. I also never show all of these files all at once because I think there is something invisible and incomplete about migrant, about clandestine migration, so I never show all of them to the viewers, but they do exist. So this is a file that I did not receive these desert drones. A little bit of sound would be nice because it's actually a sound piece. I have not received this footage of desert drones because, of course, Gaddafi didn't answer my calls. But I found out what they would look like theoretically and started to. What we can't hear it. It's no good. But I have simulated this document. It's a fake document. And it allows me to introduce also a more reflected, more theoretical level of discussion into an otherwise very documentary kind of project. Usually all these texts, they're scrolling texts, and they all go kind of all around the room. But for better reading this from the computer, it's better to have them like that. You can see the migration trails. This is usually projected, as is also the desert drone, the desert terminal. And it has a kind of compilation in the soundtrack of 15 different radio and TV stations in terms of sound. Then I want to show quickly maybe the last clip I'm going to present is an interview made with a former rebel leader of the Tuareg Rebellion, which took place in the 90s. who now runs the clandestine migration line to the north through Algeria. They use a different tactic. It's not the big trucks that go through the deadly desert of the Dinere, they have a number of small jeeps where at night they swarm out, and then they can usually just intercept one and all the others can go through. So that they use different tactics. This man was interviewed in Arlit, which is a uranium mine about 100 miles north of Agadez, which was discovered there very recently in the 60s at the height of the Cold War. So it attracted a lot of buzz, attracted a lot of people, but the Tuareg, whose land this is, never benefited from any jobs or any compensation or nothing. So this triggered the Tuareg Rebellion, where they tried to once again create a state of the Tuaregs in the desert. And this failed. So they came back. They were promised better social integration, but there were no jobs. So that was a very tricky situation. So I interviewed him. In the first part of the interview, he just speaks about how he runs this migration system.
Avec les 4x4, là, on achemine les différents immigrés qui désirent se rendre vers l'Europe. Nous avons songé à avoir des 4x4 pour faire la caravane, pour remplacer la caravane. Là où on fait avant 2 mois, 1 mois, aujourd'hui on le fait à 2 jours.
So this is about a 10-minute interview. Then he speaks about how he was asked by the military to join the armed forces.
Des armes, quoi. De la montagne, on m'avait mandaté à représenter les francs américains. Lorsqu'il y a eu les accords, j'étais revenu ici. Bon, comme ce n'est pas tout le monde qui sera intégré dans le gouvernement nigérien, je fais partie des éléments qui n'ont pas été intégrés. C'est en sachant comment désigner pour gérer ces réseaux. C'est pour m'occuper, mais en m'occupant et en même temps en me créant des problèmes. Je vois ça que c'est comme si j'étais en otage. La colonisation a fait son découpage. Alors nous faisons partie des peuples de ces 4 ou 5 pays, tels que Tchad, Niger, la Libye, l'Algérie et le Mali. Au Tchad, un Touareg vit de la même manière qu'un Touareg qui est au Mali. On ne comprend pas pourquoi tous ces 5 pays-là, ils n'ont pas centraliser la gestion de ces communautés-là. Dans les 5 pays-là qui nous entourent, quoi, et chacune se dit qu'elle a une communauté Touareg. Il y a une sorte de marginalisation. Ils n'ont pas été associés politiquement ces communautés-là.
il n'y a pas de citoyenneté.
Pour les Touaregs.
Pour les Touaregs. Elle n'a pas été reconnue. Ce n'est pas parce qu'il n'y en a pas, mais elle n'a pas été reconnue, la citoyenneté Touareg, jusqu'à présent.
So, what he was saying is actually was very interesting to me because I didn't know so much about this history that he was talking about. I found out during the interview that the fact that the Tuareg don't have their own state and they are, minorities in all these countries. They don't really identify with any of these nation states, but continue to have their trans-border connection with the other Tuareg tribes. So that actually they live a transnational existence by definition, and are therefore so extremely well-organized to run this transnational business. So I felt that at the moment where Europe is consolidating itself, this old problem of inconsiderate colonial space politics kind of re-emerges. And I think that he is perfectly aware that it is his statelessness, in a way, that is what makes him do this job where he brings so many migrants into a life of statelessness in Europe. So these things are very connected. And I felt that when you speak about these migration, it's not enough to just show these dramatic images, and it's certainly not enough to ask why they're coming and poverty and all that. We also need to understand a lot of different deeper things that have to do with colonial roots, with the way this whole system is grounded in a social practice of that whole space, and then maybe we start to begin we can begin to understand what the meaning of it is, not to combat it, but simply to know what we're up to. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. I would have liked to have seen a whole work of you in this context. Maybe we should have done this so we have more, seen just even more. But I think we have some imagination, also the one who have not been to your workshop, about the ideas you want to develop concerning picking up special social groups in a very remote zone, people and processes that are not visible to us. Maybe in contrast, I think it's we have to relate it a little to it, what we heard before about artistic work that is situated in the middle of visuality and the things that are communicated in the mass media. And now we have just another very different situation where you go somewhere else outside, not even with another museum, maybe 30 kilometers or miles away, but it's really very far away, and your work is, I have the impression, a combination about information you want to provide and something like an aesthetic organization of material that becomes something else when it's when we can see it as a whole. Would it tell us something about the relation of these parts of research, information, and the aesthetic process?
Well, I usually work a lot more in a more essayistic format where you have, which I don't do here, I don't have an overarching narrative that brings things together where I'm actually talking things through or creating some kind of theoretical strand that runs through it. I felt it was just so immense, this territory, it's so various and so disconnected, that I just gave up on it and started to work on these individual files where I could really zoom in without being forced to constantly create these connections artificially. And when I show it in the space, then you would actually end up having all this in one space, which is then a multiple kind of aesthetic experience, because you enter, and migration is a spatial practice, it's a spatialization of human relations, this desert. So I felt that I can reproduce this geographic notion of artistic practice best if I make these installations where you could actually sit down and watch, maybe more concentration, but at the same time seeing other things happen.
Okay. Obviously, you're relating yourself's work to the tradition of the essay film, but you don't use ordinary screening, as you mentioned. Is the essayistic work, or the essayistic part of your work, does this only mean the installation, or does the essay itself, or would you consider the essayistic as form of intervention itself? On a formal practice. I'm thinking about this very well-known essay from Adorno on the essay, and the essay as form. And in this very well-known essay, he's pointing out that the essay itself is an intervention against traditional orders of knowledge, traditional orders of forms, of conventionalized forms. Would you relate to this kind of transition and at the same time to the work, for example, like Harun Farrokhi or Chantal Ackerman?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I definitely relate to is that I'm not terribly interested in causal thinking. So the essay has clearly a different line of argumentation through the film that would a classic documentary film have. So it's very subjective, it's very open-ended. It's really more about thinking about society and the world, and not so much about representing reality, per se. So I'm a lot less interested in that than using it for more reflection elsewhere. So in that sense, yeah, it's not easily nailed down to be a genre, but it's always kind of a big between things, and I find that very productive to stay in this kind of in-between space, especially when you deal with border phenomena for so many years. You also have to work on borders of the disciplines somehow, and it has always kind of withdrawn somewhat from being completely worked into this machine of the art world, because it can't go completely just video art, because it's always about content, and it's a serious reflection on content, but also about the form, the thought forms, as you say, and trying to reflect that in the arrangement of the video pieces. Because yesterday in the workshop we looked at Black Sea Files, which we're going to show quickly. That a pipeline obviously is a linear formation that runs through a number of countries. That video has a different form than a network that is very loosely associated, you know. Or a circular border movement will need a different video form than this linear thing, you know. So I do try to work conceptually in that sense.
Would you say you're using filmic or video images for opposing the traditional image? I mean, images opposing images. I would say Chris Marker, for example, is trying to do this in his formal work. That's a question.
Yeah, I mean, here maybe I don't. In Black Sea Files, a whole sequence is in there where I start reflecting about the meaning of artists going to field, producing images under dangerous conditions, and so on. So I reflect more obviously about my role of artist and use different images. So it becomes very self-reflexive. That is something that we have learned from people like Chris Marker. But I think we have also to go a step further and leave these big fathers behind.
He's behind himself. He's working on
you. Oh, yeah. I have deep admiration for this producer.
With 89 years.
I have a question a little bit about intervention and partiality. There's a current discussion I follow a little bit in anthropology, whether anthropologists should be political. I mean, that's an old discussion, but it's also a new one, whether they should be political and whether they should be involved in wars, actually. And that, in a sense, what you do there with this work, you do involve in a war. I mean, whatever you know, you could really call a war. It could be a cold war or a structural war or something like that.
Conflictual spaces, we sometimes call them.
So we had a lot of examples now of artists who were very clear about their position. The position of the artist was very obvious in the beginning. Now, showing all those pictures, you run the risk, of course, to cross borders also in the other side, just to be a spy for the other side. I mean, you're producing
material. I do a lot of undercover work. It is ambivalent here because bringing illegal migration, which is an invisible part of that, you know, into visibility is a problematic thing to do, because obviously illegal migration or clandestine migration functions best when it is invisible. So I bring it to visibility, but it's also a bit compromising, perhaps. So it's sometimes difficult to say how useful it is. But I have shown it in 24 different countries in museum contexts, and which tells us also how important, how interested people are in Europe and elsewhere to learn more about what is actually happening. And I think people who will have spent some time in this installation and looked at all these files that I showed just tiny clips from now, I think they will never think about migration in quite the same way than before. So I think it's a tool for preparing people to make up their own mind in a much more informed and broader way, and to give this migration a different face, a different image. Plus, actually, I think that an interview with Adawa, this rebel leader, is a historic document, because in a few years maybe this will all be gone, and we'll never really have him kind of speaking like that. So maybe this is more like an anthropological interest or an archival interest of telling a different local history and so on of phenomena that that affects us very much. And of course I have shown this piece also in Abidjan, in Bamako, in Dakar, in lots of other places, so and in the Maghreb and in Cairo. So it's a way of triggering a lot of discussion around it. Yes.
Ja, Ihren Film fand ich sehr interessant und ich hätte ihn auch gerne ganz gesehen. Nur stellt sich mir eine bitte. Nur stellt sich bei mir eine Frage, die sich auch in anderen Fällen stellt und die vielleicht naiv wirken kann. Ich meine, wo ist, insofern ist das, warum wird das Kunst genannt und nicht Dokumentation? Wo ist da die Grenze? Ich meine, abgesehen davon, gut, das ist, sicher hat das einen anderen Rhythmus als jetzt zum Beispiel eine Reportage fürs Fernsehen. Und gut, die sagen, es wird auf Monitoren gezeigt. Aber in der ganzen Struktur sehe ich nicht, während ich so etwas von einem normalen Dokumentarfilm unterscheide. Das meine ich gar nicht pejorativ. Mir ist ein guter Dokumentarfilm wesentlich lieber etwas, was krampfhaft Kunst sein will, wie die Prada-Werbung, die wir vorher gesehen haben. Aber ich stelle mir, ich meine, ich interessiere mich so persönlich eigentlich mehr für politisches Zeitgeschehen als nun unbedingt für ästhetische Tendenzen. Aber ich stelle mir einfach die Frage nach den Grenzen der Genre, die ist vielleicht heute in der Ästhetik nicht mehr so wichtig wie früher, aber für mich stellt sie sich doch immer wieder. Warum wird sowas, könnte doch zum Beispiel genauso gut an einer Biennale gezeigt werden, wie auch zum Beispiel in einer Journalismusschule?
Ja, wird es auch.
Und es wird halt immer wieder auch, zum Beispiel, es wird auch sehr oft im Museumsbereich, da wird noch einfach Fotos ausgestellt, die für mich einfach reine Dokumentation sind. Und da ging es auch nicht einzuwenden, aber wer bestimmt da, wo die Grenzen sind, dann könnte eigentlich überhaupt jede Art auch von Journalismus oder von Dokumentation eben gleichfalls in die Kunst, zur Kunst gerechnet werden. Wer entscheidet dann überhaupt noch, was nun ins eine Töpfchen gehört und was ins andere gehört?
Ich glaube, das mit den Töpfchen ist nicht mehr so relevant. Also ich denke, dass wir nicht wahnsinnig viel gewinnen, indem wir diese Dinge festmachen an so Designations und so Bezeichnungen. Und als ich aus der Kunstschule kam, da war eigentlich diese ganze Kunsttheorie und der Kunstdiskurs schon total kontaminiert durch Cultural Studies and Postcolonial Theory und all diese Dinge. Und mir war eigentlich von Anfang an klar, dass Kunsttheorie nicht mehr der einzige relevante Rahmen sein kann, durch den meine Kunst, meine Arbeit verstanden wird. Ob das jetzt, wo das gezeigt wird, solange es ja diese Diskussionen überall auslösen kann, dann tut es eigentlich. Viel wichtiger ist, dass man eine Form findet, die eigentlich dem Problem intelligent entsprechen kann. Und nicht irgendwelche, und sich nicht nur immer in diese Kunsttheorie und Geschichte einschreiben, das wäre mir einfach.
Ja, das war immer so, dass er überholt. Aber wenn ich jetzt zum Beispiel ein Student bin und einen Dokumentarfilm drehe, ob ich ihn dann in einer Kunsthochschule so vorlege oder in einer Journalismusschule, würde doch sicher unterschiedlich beurteilt werden. Da gibt es schon einen Unterschied. Eine Kunsthochschule würde zum Beispiel sicher andere Ansprüche stehen an einem Film als, wie gesagt, eine Journalismusschule.
Ja, das ist schon so. Ich meine, ich treffe diese Leute ja alle an im Feld, die Journalisten, die Soziologen, die Geografen, die Anthropologen, und wir fragen ja oft dieselben Fragen. Aber ich glaube, das Produkt am Schluss ist ein anderes. Und auch so, wie ich dann reflektiere in den Texten und wie es ausgestellt wird, das ist eine völlig andere Erfahrung und läuft eigentlich über andere Circuits, über andere Kanäle. Und es wird anders verhandelt. Aber ich finde, diese Dinge müssen auch, ich meine, die Kunst ist dafür da, dass man diesen symbolischen Raum, also diese symbolischen Produktionen verhandelt. Und ich finde, das gehört da auch mit dazu.
Eine Frage haben wir noch, aber dann müssen wir, glaube ich, wirklich.
Ja, da ist noch
was machen. Sonst, wir haben nachher wirklich noch Raum. Ne? Wir haben jetzt eben so abgekürzt, dass es jetzt nicht wirklich.
Mich würde interessieren, Sie haben das schon thematisiert, also diese Rolle, der politische Rolle, die Rolle der verschiedenen europäischen Länder in diesem ganzen Geschehen. Ja. Inwiefern thematisieren Sie Involviertheit der europäischen Regierungen und jetzt die Agentur Frontex und so weiter, also diese andere Seite in diesem ganzen Geschehen in Ihren Arbeiten? Und denken Sie das auch, also diesbezüglich eine Sichtbarmachung eher in Richtung einer Intervention gehen würde.
Jetzt in dieser Arbeit thematisiere ich es nicht so sehr, aber es kommt natürlich indirekt zur Sprache, weil man ja weiß, dass alle diese Veränderungen zurückzuführen sind auf Frontex-Efforts und die verstärkten Border-Regimes. Ich schreibe ein bisschen darüber in meinen Texten. Ich sehe die immer auch das geht immer hin und zurück zwischen Text und Video bei mir. Das ist nicht nur so, dieses Produkt muss alles sagen, und wenn man nur das gesehen hat, dann weiß man es. Aber ich habe andere Werke gemacht, wo das ein bisschen stärker zum Zug kommt. Ich fand es wichtiger, mal diesen ganzen Raum, in dem eine Visualität zu geben, als wieder eine Eigenkritik über diese Grenzregimes. Man macht das immer.
Ich würde gerne hier eine Zäsur setzen, eigentlich sehr ungern, wie auch vorhin ich die sehr ungern gesetzt habe. Ich denke, da gibt es viele Anknüpfungspunkte noch von beiden Vorträgen zu dem, einmal, was wir morgen machen werden. Also wenn wir uns auch über architektonische Entwürfe und Urbanität unterhalten werden, also künstlerische Formen, die im urbanen Raum intervenieren oder im digitalen oder medialen Raum. Ich denke, dass wir, Frau Faber, auf Ihren Vortrag da auch nochmal ganz intensiv zurückkommen, auch im Kontext nochmal einer Politik der Bilder und auch bezogen auf die Politik der Bilder auch nochmal Ursula Biemanns Entwurf aufgreifen werden. Also dass das jetzt hier alles nicht verloren wird, sondern wir wollen das gerne im Zusammenhang sehen. Und wir werden uns versuchen, so gut auf die Panel-Diskussion vorzubereiten, dass wir die offenen Fragen gut kanalisieren und produktiv zusammenführen können. Jetzt würde ich Ihnen aber erstmal 10 Minuten Kaffeepause gönnen, bevor wir weitermachen. Ja.